From the Sky News Centre at 5, a magistrate has found John Terry not guilty of hurling racist abuse at a fellow professional. The Chelsea and England defender has spent the week on trial at Westminster Magistrates Court, accused of racism against QPR's Anton Ferdinand. Terry refused to comment as he left. Chelsea's chairman, Bruce Buck, did speak to reporters outside.
We are pleased that John can now put his mind to football and go back to training and do what he's done for many years.
Rangers new co-owner Charles Green will accept his team starting next season in the third division. Scottish Football League clubs have voted to admit the fallen Glasgow Giants into the fourth tier. Mr Green says it's not something they can argue about.
This decision maintains sporting integrity that the clubs and fans across Scotland have been calling for. But it also impacts massively on Scottish football as a whole, and only time will tell what those consequences will be.
Relatives of the 9 climbers killed by an avalanche in the French Alps have gathered in Chamonix to pay their respects. The group included Steve Barber and John Taylor from a village near York, and Roger Payne, a former General Secretary of the British Mountaineering Council. The chief executive of G4S, the company employed to provide security at the Olympics, will be questioned by MPs next week. Nick Buckles will have to explain why it's failed to fulfil a £284 million contract, leaving 3,500 troops to fill the void. More than 100 new free schools have been approved to open in England. It virtually doubles the number of schools which get state funding but are independent of local authorities. Most are due to open from September next year. That's the latest. I'm Rachel Jewell.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Hello Bristol, and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping us review this week's news is Liberal Democrat councillor for King's Weston, Simon Rayner. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. In the second hour after six, in a national financial emergency which is hitting the sick, the young and the elderly worst, why is it the super rich and multinational corporations pay virtually no tax? Tax havens are in the crosshairs this week, those places that all politicians want to close, but nobody ever seems to get round to doing anything about. John Christensen from the Tax Justice Campaign will be joining us. And Bristol had a distinguished visitor this week. Ronnie Casserils was one of the main organisers of the 1980s-focused anti-apartheid movement, which helped the African National Congress overthrow the white minority racist government in South Africa. And we hear from him on the eve of Bristol's EDL march. He has some film tips and also advice on today's struggles, plus Martin Summers' weekly roundup of world events. That's all in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 11 Celsius and some light rain. This weekend, highs 16 Celsius, some showers on Saturday, but sunny. On Sunday, is that actually a day of guaranteed sun? I do hope so. Next week, highs of 20 Celsius, fairly cloudy week with some sunny spells and some showers, although it's drier than of late. Now, hopefully, we're going to get a little bit of sun, because ever since they had the hosepipe ban back in the spring, I'm sure it's been just showery ever since. There's hardly been any sun, has there? Next weekend, 21st and 22nd of July, highs of 16 Celsius, sunny, hopefully, next weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, now time to introduce this week's guest, and helping us review this week's news is Liberal Democrat councillor for King's Weston, Simon Rayner. Hi, Simon, and welcome to Drive Time.
Good afternoon.
Now, first of all, the big issue in the city at the moment is this whole business of the mayor, and that an elected mayor is going to be foisted on us. Now we've decided that's what we want, apparently, during a referendum at the end of the year. What are your thoughts about the rights and wrongs of that, first of all?
Well, I didn't support the case for having a mayor. I was sided with the no vote. My feeling was that it concentrates too much power in the hands of one person, and it would be very difficult for that person to, you know, even have a decent mandate from the city, and let alone to be able to represent the kind of diverse, the needs of the diverse communities around the city. But, you know, the referendum went the other way. So now we will have a mayor, and I'm focused on making sure that that's a Liberal Democrat mayor.
Now, how are the Liberal Democrats getting on in deciding who they want to be their mayoral candidate? Because I know the Labour Party have put forward someone. There are other people who have put themselves forward. What about the Lib Dems?
Well, we have a slightly bureaucratic process of selecting a candidate, which is decided by the kind of national party. We're quite a long way through that process now, and we have a shortlist of candidates, and we're a party where every member has one vote, so every member of the Liberal Democrat Party in Bristol will be able to vote on which candidate they want.
So which candidate do you want, and who would you like to see?
As part of the bureaucratic rules of the process, we're
don't tell me you're not allowed to say.
We're told, you know, we're not actually meant to discuss even who is standing. I think it was in the press earlier anyway. I think that either of them would do a good job, I'll make my decision when I've heard them speak about more about their ideas for Bristol.
Now, Barbara Jenks stood down earlier this year and Simon Cook took over. Was that because Barbara had been an anti-mayoral council leader? She'd been against the idea of a mayor, and had Simon been pro-mayor? And that's why it was felt that it was a good idea to switch, because, or at least maybe one of the reasons, because it's not necessarily a good idea in the run-up to having a mayor takeover to have someone as a council leader who's not in favour of the idea.
No, not as I understand. That's not the reason, as I understand it. Barbara has been leader of the Liberal Democrat Party in Bristol for a very long time, and well before I was involved in the Liberal Democrats, and taking it from being a small, you know, a very small minority party on the council to having an overall majority on the council. That's a very demanding job, and I think she took the view that now would be or then would be a good time to step down and let someone else take on the job.
Okay, Simon, well, tell us a bit about yourself. What got you interested in politics? When did you first get involved, and why the Lib Dems?
I suppose I've gradually got more involved in politics. I think when I was a teenager, politics was something I was only really vaguely aware of. And then I went to university, and I met a lot of people who had strong political opinions. I got more and more interested in politics from then. I was studying architecture at the time, so not necessarily directly connected. And I continued to pursue that career. I joined the Liberal Democrats during, I can't remember the exact year, but I got increasingly upset by some of the things that the new Labour government was doing in relation to civil liberties, things like the ID cards and, proposals to detain people without charge for ever-increasing amounts of time. And that kind of stuff really started to wind me up. And the Liberal Democrats were actually taking a principled stand against those things, and so I kind of overcame my cynicism about party politics and decided to join the Liberal Democrats.
Okay. What about your architecture? You're doing that now still, are you? Have you gone on and you have a part-time job in that architecture?
Yeah, so I still do that 3 days a week, and my council work and my kind of council duties and the work that I do in my ward takes up the other 2 days and a lot of my other time.
But so when we're strolling around the city, can we see little things that you've designed, or bits of buildings, or whole buildings? Come on, whereabouts is your architecture itself?
I was involved in the design of Aardman Animation's headquarters. I work for a company called Alec French Architects, and so I was involved in that project, which is a nice building on Spike Island, just south of the harbour. I was also involved in a fairly small way on the Environment Agency headquarters behind the council house, and more recently I worked on a building in Kingswood for it's called the Children's Locality Hub, and it's where they bring together services, health services and social services for children, so that they can all work together and hopefully make them more effective.
Okay, and now this is a big question, but give us an idea. What is the Liberal Democrat vision for the city? You're the largest party. You've got quite a lot of power. Are you sure you're taking the city in the right direction?
I think we are, yeah. I think we're actually increasingly in the last couple of years, it's you know, the difference that we're making has become more obvious. We're you know, we've invested in we're improving things like recycling rates in the city. We're going to be the first city, I think, in the country to send zero waste to landfill. We're devolving power to communities in a very meaningful way, so that rather than decisions about things that affect communities being taken centrally, local people and their local councillors get a say in how those things are done. You know, we're making sure that the primary schools, the potential primary schools problem is addressed. We've attracted money for investment in transport schemes, which is obviously a major issue in Bristol. So, yeah, I think we do have a vision and we're delivering on it.
Okay, Simon. Now, what about issues that have been brought up over in King's Weston? Because what's the sort of stuff that you as a council, you say you're doing 2 days a week or so. When your constituents, the people who are living in the city, are coming to you, what kind of problems are they coming with, and how, if any way, are you able to actually help them?
Well, it varies enormously, and they vary enormously in the kind of the scale and scope of the problem. So I have individuals who will approach me about very individual problems, and I can only kind of talk about them in general terms, because they're obviously, some of them are quite private, but frequently they're housing problems, so people having problems with the condition of their housing, or trying to move to another house or get a council house and struggling to do that, or having problems with their neighbours, those sort of things. But I also deal with kind of larger issues like planning, you know, when there are planning applications in the area and that people want to comment on or oppose. And then there's a whole load of much broader issues which aren't just, you know, which affect the whole community, which I'm trying to get addressed. So, for example, my ward actually has no decent children's playground in the whole ward. It's a ward of I think between 8,000 and 9,000 people, and in Seamills there is one very run down playground, and in Lawrence Weston, which is the northern part of the ward, there's basically nothing. So I've been working very hard to try and identify sites for building playgrounds and to get the money to build them, which have now succeeded. It's taken a bit longer than I expected, but have now secured, I think it's £130,000 to create a new playground in the south part of Seamills, £140,000 to create a brand new park and playground in the north part of Seamills, and a similar amount of money to spend on a new park in on a new playground in Ridingleys in Lawrence Weston.
So how have you managed to find all this money in a so-called recession?
Well, it's been a combination of sources. One of the sources is Section 106 money. So that's the money that developers pay to the council when they get a planning consent, and that's to mitigate the impact of the development.
Well, some would call that a bribe, wouldn't they? But although it's not officially a bribe. It's that you will give them planning permission for something, and in exchange for that, they'll say, well, we will build something for the community, or give some money for something to be built. And it's a sort of quid pro quo.
There are very clear guidelines as to what scale of development merits certain amounts of money. So if you're building housing, then obviously that's going to increase the number of families in an area and put extra pressure on things like parks and schools, and developers are then expected to make certain contributions. So some of the money is coming from that source, but what tends to happen is that money isn't quite enough for what the community wants, and so it tends to sit there. But we've now been able to unlock it, because the power to spend that money has been devolved to the neighbour partnerships, so to the local councillors for those local communities, and then we've also been able to top it up by basically a Liberal Democrat council initiative. We've managed to get £3.5 million to invest as capital investment in parks across the city, and bids were invited from communities to spend that money, and the bids for King's Weston were very successful.
Well, I mean, the reason I say bribe, and you sort of blanch slightly when I said that, is because I'm thinking along the lines of things like when Tesco's will want to build one of their massive superstores, and they say, well, I'll tell you what, if you give us planning permission, we'll build you a school, or we'll build you a junction on your motorway. But anyway, sounds like you're doing some good stuff there, Simon. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is joining us too. Martin, last week it was the chief executive. This week it was the chairman of Barclays, Marcus Agius. So we have another Treasury Select Committee and another load of I can't remember this week from the Barclays chairman.
Yeah, well, it's an ongoing saga, isn't it? I mean, I think what happens with ordinary people who are struggling over playgrounds and things is that this is becoming, that it's a bore. They don't follow it in detail like anoraks like me and you, Tony. But at the same time, people are beginning to sense that the people at the top are, in fact, crooked. And this is a real question about whether these people should be prosecuted. Never mind being put in front of select committees and given a hard time. If you've broken the law, maybe you should be prosecuted, especially if we're going to send so-called rioters to prison for, you know, years for stealing bottles of water. What happens when you've got your fingers in the till at the top? At the moment, it looks like nothing.
Well, let's have a listen to Marcus Agius at the Treasury Select Committee on Tuesday. He's also a trustee of the BBC, so he's been one of the people who's just appointed a new Director General of the BBC. And he's also one of a handful of UK people attending the annual financial conference, which is all secret, started by a former Nazi, Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands. That's the Bilderberg Conference. So let's have a listen to Marcus Agius at Treasury Select Committee on Tuesday. And if you've got a Barclays account, ask yourself if you can trust the man who's looking after your mortgage or savings. So here he is, Marcus Agius, the chairman of Barclays.
It says here, and I'm quoting you here, this is your letter. It says, it was clear that the tone from the top is one of the FSA's concerns. That's you saying this to Lord Turnham a couple of months ago.
That's in response to his letter to me.
Yes. But you're saying the tone from the top in your letter is one of their concerns, and you're telling us now it wasn't.
I'm telling you what Andrew Berry told me.
Well, why does your letter say that the tone from the top is one of the FSA's concerns?
Because that is a different exchange from the visit to the board, and it was on as a result, I mentioned, of what my interview with Lord Turner and his subsequent letter that led me to write what I wrote.
But either the tone from the top is a concern of the FSA or it isn't. So which is it?
I'm sorry. What my letter says, the board and I took note of Andrew Bailey's comments in our February meeting, and while he specifically excluded Bob Diamond and Chris Lucas from his comments, it's clear that turn from the top is one of the FSA's concerns. So it should be.
Exactly. But you keep saying the turn from the top wasn't one of their concerns.
So there was the chairman of Barclays there arguing the toss with the Treasury Select Committee. Martin, it doesn't sound very convincing to me. And I wonder where's the value of these Treasury Select Committees when, you know, all he seems to do is sort of fudge away or say, well, I don't actually remember, or else it's, well, maybe yes, maybe no. He's not really committing himself to anything.
Yeah, I mean, that could be construed as contempt of Parliament. It would be interesting to see if it was so construed. I mean, basically, shining a light into these murky depths, as it were, is obviously going to be a bit tricky. And the Parliamentary Select Committee seems like to be a toothless talking shop. I mean, that's what conclusion people may draw from this. But at least some light is being shed on the matter, and let's hope more will be shed as we proceed.
Well, the other thing that happened this week is on Max Kaiser, the Kaiser Report on Russia Today, we had a chap called Ian Fraser on, and his theory is, and maybe I could ask you about this, Martin, do you know when the last big prosecution was in the City of London?
I do, because you told me earlier, Tony.
Well, you could try.
1992.
And which one was that then?
I don't know, because you only mentioned
okay,
it.
Okay, which one was it then?
Oh, you did mention it. Yes, I'm sorry, sir. Bank of Credit and Commerce International, which is a real can of worms of the era.
It certainly was the early 90s that the last prosecutions took place. But anyway, Ian Fraser on the Kaiser Report had some very interesting stuff to say about this whole sort of culture of impunity, because it seems that there are laws there. I mean, it's a bit like the press and Leveson, where there are laws against phone hacking, but the police simply haven't prosecuted people for them, and that's why Leveson's happened. The similar thing is
phone tapping, of course.
Well, a similar thing has been going on with the banking sector, Martin.
Well, yes, and I think what's happening is we're seeing the structure of power inside the British state gradually being revealed, and it's not a pretty sight, is it?
Well, let's have a listen now to Ian Fraser on the Kaiser Report then.
The rot really set in at Big Bang in 86 when Mrs. Thatcher's government deregulated the financial sector and she demolished the silo-like structures and the partnerships that used to exist within the city. And in those days, I'm not saying it was totally clean, but it was less easy for conflicts of interest and corruption to occur. There's various key dates as I see it. 1992 was a key date when there was the last ever criminal trial of high-level bankers from the City of London, which was the Blue Arrow trial. Three senior executives of a bank called County NatWest were given suspended sentences for rigging a rights issue. And one stockbroker who helped them from UBS, Phillips and Drew, was also given a suspended sentence for rigging a rights issue. Now, the trouble was, this didn't go down particularly well with the establishment, so they engineered a Court of Appeal case in July 92 where the sentences were quashed. And on the day of the quashing of the sentences, a friend of mine was phoned by a contact of his in the SFO, Serious Fraud Office. And the contact in the Serious Fraud Office basically said, the message has come down from on high. There will never again be a prosecution of a high-level banker or a mainstream city institution. So it would appear that from that moment on, there was a kind of new agenda had been set whereby people in the city, and bankers in particular, were given carte blanche to do as they chose. This could include false accounting, defrauding their clients, could include money laundering. And it seems that a dangerous precedent was set at that moment. But the situation, if anything, got worse under Tony Blair and Gordon Brown when in 2000 they passed an act called the Financial Services and Markets Act 2000, which included a clause which said that the competitiveness of the city was more important than the rule of law. It said that regulators must consider the international mobility of the financial businesses before taking enforcement action, and they must avoid damaging the UK's competitiveness. So essentially, they were telling the FSA, the newly born FSA, that it should always consider whether or not financial institutions might move overseas before they prosecuted them.
So apparently also the Blair-Brown government was saying that the rule of law was less important than international competitiveness, Martin. I think you were hoping you were going to get off with saying it was a Tory government that engineered the lack of the rule of law in the City of London, but clearly it's not.
I think the real problem is the political power of the City of London is so great that they can control both major political parties. And look at the way Vince Cable has been treated since he's tried to discipline them. They are overmighty subjects. We need the Court of Star Chamber to put them in the box.
Okay, what about...
I think it's interesting how close, you know, both the Tory Party and the Labour Party managed to get to the banks. And, you know, Gordon Brown in particular was always seemed very, very wary of upsetting the financial sector. And, you know, Vince Cable was a kind of lone voice who was saying that a lot of what the banks are doing is problematic and is likely to land the economy in dangerous trouble well before it did. You know, since it happened, he's been the voice. He's been saying that what really needs to happen is for lots of these banks, the larger banks, to be split up so that their kind of casino speculation arms are taken away from their kind of everyday retail banking. The thing that really interested me about how this story unfolded last week was the clever PR strategy that I think Barclays probably instigated, which is that the focus very quickly came onto what the Bank of England had been saying to Bob Diamond, and you know whether the Bank of England had somehow been involved in persuading Barclays to manipulate its interest rates, and you know even politicians like George Osborne jumped on that argument and started talking about it in Parliament. But the real scandal was actually that nothing to do with that at all. It was before that when Barclays was manipulating its interest rates to to benefit its traders. They had people who were effectively betting on the LIBOR rate, talking to their mates in the other arm of the bank, saying, can you manipulate your rates and we'll make a bit of money out of it.
So the people who've bought their own homes, who've paid thousands of pounds to Barclays and other people too much in their mortgage, going to get their money back?
I mean, I don't know how it's going to work in this country, but what's clear is that in, you know, in the USA, actually the regulations on this are stricter, and they obviously have a far more litigious society, and you know there are now lawyers and large organizations who've lost out queuing up to sue Barclays.
Martin, the Serious Fraud Office, this an interesting little phone call apparently at the time of the Blue Circle case. But what he's saying there, Ian Fraser, is that we're now in a situation where there's a carte blanche, basically, for false accounting and money laundering. And this has been going on now for something like 20 years in the City of London. So what does that tell us about the state of it as an institution now?
Well, what's interesting, of course, two points. This attempt to protect the reputation of the city by telling fibs, which went on for two decades, could lead to the complete implosion of the city. Once these cases get running in the US, they're going to bankrupt our banks, because they got the lawyers there will take them to the cleaners if they're shown to have been fixing the rate. And that's what will happen. Therefore, instead of protecting the reputation of the City of London by saying, don't tell people that we're cheating, by cheating, you actually destroy the reputation of your financial centre. And we're going to see that play out. And the other point I would make, it's your...
If I can help you out, yes. The Blue Circle case that he mentioned, yes. There, he was saying something fascinating there. That was that the bankers involved were given suspended sentences. That is to say, they weren't actually jailed. They were just given a little slap on the wrist and told, don't do it again, otherwise we will jail you. But then there was a Court of Appeal case, he says, was engineered in order to get them off, even from those suspended sentences. Yeah. I mean, how on earth do the courts... are the courts able to, or the banks able to sort of just twist the arm of the judges, are they then? Or, I mean, how does that kind of thing happen?
Well, it looks like it, doesn't it?
The Court of Appeals is totally compromised here.
Yeah, I mean, that's what it looks like. I mean, in 2008, there's a report by the UN Office on Crime and Drugs, and I've mentioned it before on this show, and it was put together by them in 2009, and they pointed out that all the dirty money that had been hanging around for years and years and years and years and years during the 2008 crisis was just sucked straight into the banking system. So the drug cartels went to the people running the banks, who they know very well, because of course drug cartel people know bankers quite well, and they said, look, you guys need some money, don't you? They said, yes, we're having a panic. Would you like some? Because we've got loads. And virtually the whole of the dirty money in the system was dragged into the system in one go, like a big sucking noise, slurp. And therefore, we've now got a situation where the international financial institutions are being propped up, A, by the taxpayer, B, by the drug cartels, and C, they're beyond the law.
Simon,
how
would you and your party, Vince Cable, particularly deal with this situation of what looks like, you know, basically overt criminality going on, and really a whole culture of impunity from the super rich, from these big banking corporations?
Well, I hope that the problem doesn't extend, you know, quite as far as you know, corruption in the judiciary, and that actually, you know, maybe that is a conspiracy theory too far. But banks are responsible for handling, you know, huge amounts of people's money, and they need to be institutions that can be trusted, and to do that they need to be properly regulated, and that's something that the Liberal Democrat Party has been arguing for loudly, both before the last election and since being a part of the coalition.
But I mean, if they've been doing false accounting, which it certainly looks like they were, even in the run up to the 2008 financial disaster, I mean, you know, these banks, they were on the books, they were fine, but then they suddenly said, well, actually, we can't cope anymore. Certainly, that's a criminal offence, isn't it? False accounting.
Well, if they've committed fraud, then you know, I would hope that will be investigated by the appropriate authorities and it would be punished. They're also, I mean, I think that a lot of the a lot of the things that happened in the banking crisis weren't due to necessarily to outright fraud, but they were due to very kind of clever systems of accounting and very clever ways of taking risks off their balance sheets, so that they weren't clear to the regulators and people thought that actually the banks were much safer than they actually turned out to be.
Martin, can you just explain a bit of that jiggery pokery? How does it work?
Well, I mean, Enron accounting just about sums it up. If you remember what Enron were doing, they had one set of books which they presented to the, you know, the authorities, and they had all these structured investment vehicles. I mean, that was the basic scam that Enron worked out. Is you don't have to put, if you create all these other vehicles, you can put all your losses in
vehicles. What do you mean?
Well, they're kind of sub companies of the main company, so that the main company then they have relations with the main company where money, it's transfer pricing. Multinational companies do this, where they can basically move the money around in this maze that they've created, so that the bit where they have to pay tax is the bit where the least money is, and the bit where they have to account for what they're doing is not where, you know, in terms of what their profits are, is not where the real money is. And there's actually more than two sets of books.
Enron was outright fraud, and it was prosecuted as such. But whereas I think a lot of what the banks were doing involved doing things like making loans and then packaging them up with other loans and then dividing them up and then selling them to each other, so it looked like the risk was kind of spread through
Absolutely. The
system, and that, you know, if one bank started struggling, it wouldn't be a problem. But what it actually meant is no one really quite knew who had responsibility for exactly. for which
those diced up CDO products, which is the whole basis of this financial revolution, should never have been allowed. Brooksley Bourne, who was the head of the Securities and Exchange Commission in the US, when they lobbied her, can we develop these new products, she said, well, no. They're just not. You just can't. These kind of products are forbidden for a reason. Like there are challenges now in the US with people saying a mortgage document is a mortgage document, and they actually haven't got one. There's the line of property, you know, just doesn't. It's being challenged in court because a mortgage document used to be a relationship between our lender and our borrower. And there's a question about whether any of this was legal.
So what you're saying is someone's taken out a mortgage, there's a mortgage certificate with the mortgagee, and then that has been traded with somebody else and somebody else. When it comes to actually evicting somebody, it's very difficult to actually produce evidence and an audit trail from that original mortgage to the person that owns it.
Talking about corruption of the judicial process in the US, the judiciary has been used to evict people despite the fact that it looks as if it's illegal. But various lawyers are taking them to court and saying, hang on a minute, this doesn't add up. Most people just give up. When the bank comes and says they want the house back, they generally just walk away. In the US, if you walk away, you're not responsible for the debt, so you hand the keys back. In Britain, that's not so.
I mean, the broader issue is that the banks have been able to create these mind-bogglingly complicated ways of moving money around and hiding their assets and liabilities, which very few people seem to understand. I think, you know, the regulators have obviously struggled to keep up with, and I think, you know, there's a lot of very clever people who work in the city creating these products, but none of them quite had a grasp on what the impact would be when they started going wrong.
Okay, well,
you put your finger on it earlier, which is in actual fact this idea of spreading risk through the system, and therefore it's safer. What you've done is you've undermined the whole system, and the whole system goes down. Not an individual bank, not an individual banker, the whole system goes down when it goes down, and that's what we're staring in the face, actually.
Okay, on to another story this week, a sort of crisis of regulation again, and armed forces are on Olympic standby for the £535 million G4S contract for the London Olympics. I mean, this is a subject close to the heart of this show, as it's a topic exactly 3 weeks ago we were covering, and it's actually made big news this week as the army stepped in, bringing 3,500 troops in, and the announcement made on Wednesday afternoon. Simon Rayner, you're a Lib Dem councillor in the city. Can you just tell us what your thoughts are about this? Because it's literally just over 2 weeks to go, and it sounds like a complete shambles at G4S. They haven't actually got staff trained up, and not enough staff to actually manage the security for one of the most important events of the last 100 years.
Well, this story only really broke yesterday, and I saw the Channel 4 News coverage on it, and of course it's pretty worrying to be in that kind of a position 2 weeks before the start of the Olympics. I don't know a huge amount of the details, so I don't know how predictable it was that this was going to happen, but I understand that there were staff and recruits for G4S who were saying there was likely to be a problem, but they somehow managed to keep it.
But the point being, really, a month ago we heard from the chairman of G4S in the Guardian front page that in 5 years' time all of our police will be run by G4S.
Well, I think that's the worrying longer term story, isn't it? I mean, I think there's a there's an important matter of principle there as well. You know, should you have private companies taking on that kind of role from the state? And I would say the answer to that is definitely not. But it's particularly worrying when the type of companies that are putting themselves forward to take on that role are showing themselves to be less than competent.
Martin, 2 weeks ago we had Simon Israel on Channel 4 News. Since you're obviously a fan, I mean, I try and watch it when I can.
John Snow is one of my heroes.
Simon Israel on Channel 4 News 2 weeks ago, along with Jonathan Evans, the Director General of MI5, saying actually the Olympics, everything is safe. There are rumours going around that maybe there's a problem with G4S. It's all absolutely watertight. No need to worry at all. Jonathan Evans even hinting that there may be it may be a target for the Iranians. Now we hear actually the real target is the fact that there was, if things had been allowed to run their course, going to be a security shambles at the Olympics.
Well, as we know, because we had our undercover agent, as it were, phoning in to this show 3 weeks ago telling us exactly that. I think this is parallel to what we're talking about the banks. If you've got a problem with your security, what do you do? Or if you've got a problem with the banks that we haven't got enough money to pay everybody, what do you do? Do you lie about it so that you don't cause a panic? Or do you put your hand up and say, actually, this is a bit of a shambles, we need something done here?
What we're saying here is
that we've just gone over that divide now. So we've got MI5 saying it's all under control and the real problem is the Iranians. And then suddenly, oh no, actually, the real problem is that you haven't organised it properly. And of course, suddenly it's a different ball game, isn't it? It's not the banks are fine, the security's fine, and then suddenly, oh no, it's not. Now, you're much better in most problems in life. You know this from your personal life, people. If you've got a problem, you might as well face up to it sooner rather than later.
And it's also another example of privatised profit and public risk. You know, these companies are quite happy to take their profit and take the credit when things are going well. When things start going wrong, they turn to the state and the taxpayers are expected to take the cost.
And then suddenly the government has to step in. This is what will happen. I mean, I think we're going to see in the medium term a return to a belief in effective government rather than competition as a means of achieving outcomes. I think that's what the final result of all this chaos is.
Simon, one of the things that bothers me, I mean, we had this interview, people put it up on YouTube, took the radio interview and put pictures on it, something like 200,000 viewings as a viral video online. And then I was contacted by the BBC. I was also contacted by the Daily Mirror. This is before this week's announcement, and yet still they didn't want to run the story. They didn't actually want to talk about it until this announcement by the army. So it does make you wonder whether our national press is up to it. If someone has actually risked themselves by going undercover, goes to the national press with a story like this, then we're hearing actually nothing about it until the army step in and change things.
Yeah, I mean, I find that pretty strange. I'm not sure what the reasoning would be for the media not to take an interest in.
Well, I can tell you one reason from the editor of the Daily Mirror, which was that because Ben Fellows, who was the undercover reporter, had gone in there as a filmmaker rather than as a security guard, they didn't really want to run the story. If he'd gone in as a security guard and just come to them as a security guard and said, look, I've got a story to tell you, then they would have.
So they thought that maybe he had just gone in there looking for some sort of sensationalist problem and had maybe exaggerated it. I don't know the exact details of why the people you've been talking to weren't taken seriously earlier. I suppose there's a possibility that the media may have been reluctant to expose security flaws, in it may have encouraged people to take advantage of them. But it's clearly in the public interest that this problem was identified and sorted out as soon as possible. I'm kind of surprised that as far as I know, no MPs were kind of involved earlier on. If there were people from, employees of G4S who were concerned, I'm surprised that none of them contacted their local MPs.
Martin, what is G4S?
Well, I haven't got a massive knowledge about G4S. I understand they are the second biggest company in the world after Walmart. So they're not just a British-based company, they are security experts in all over the world. They've got massive contracts in the state of Israel, for example. I don't think they're an Israeli-based company. But I think, as I identified when I was talking about this in previous weeks, one of the real problems of having privatised security is not just that they're incompetent, but they're also infiltratable by people who might want to carry out terrorist attacks or what look like terrorist attacks by other people.
The other side of this, of course, is that we've got former Home Secretary John Reid is one of the directors
actors. And I think you mentioned a former chief policeman.
Yes, Paul Condon is also on the board of Chief Arrest.
And it does start to look as if these are sort of pats on the back which are given to these people when they've come out of political office, Simon. Then they're made a director of this massive private company which is working in the same sort of area. Now, whilst both of these people have been in office, they have helped facilitate the rise of G4S as a company. So is that right, that they should then be, after they've left public service, be made a private person in charge of a company of such magnitude?
Well, I find that, you know, really concerning. I mean, I suppose there is an argument that if you've had several years of public service and you have an understanding of how government works, then you're very well placed to advise those companies, and they may have legitimate reasons for taking you on. But I think it starts looking pretty dodgy when you've been, you know, directly involved in making decisions. I mean, I don't know the details of the cases you just mentioned, but if you've been directly involved in making some decisions that seemingly benefit those companies and then gone to be employed by them. And I think that problem probably extends less to politicians, actually, and is more of an issue in the civil service. I think if you read the pages of Private Eye, it's very, very common to see this kind of revolving door between people who advise on policy in the civil service and then, having advised on such policies, pop up in the very companies that benefit, including the most obvious example is during the privatisation of the railways.
Okay, so as a sort of parting shot from Lee Hazeldine, well, that was his pseudonym, his real name is outed now as Ben Fellows, the undercover reporter involved. He spoke to some interviewers in London on another YouTube video after all this had happened. This is about a week and a half ago. And he talks about the idea of, he went into this whole thing thinking, well, maybe there's a bigger picture to this. It's not just incompetence. It may be that G4S, as Martin Summer was saying the other week, are actually working with people who have a potential, and maybe putting a potential terror threat on. And if it's a private company, there are quite a lot of those around, Martin, aren't there nowadays? Private security industry.
One that people need to keep an eye on is ICTS. ICTS. It's an Israeli-based company. Its headquarters is in Tel Aviv. They were in charge of Schiphol Airport when the so-called underpants bomber got on the plane, although eyewitnesses, Kurt Haskell and his wife Laurie Haskell, who are lawyers, and it's been all over the international media, but not over our media, apart from on BCFM, he got on the plane without going through security, without a passport and without a visa. And that Schiphol Airport, you see, once you privatise security, these companies bid to take over the privatised security, but how reliable are they? Who wins these contracts? ICTS ran all three airports on 9/11. They ran Schiphol Airport, and there's a suspicion that they may have been involved in the Peter Power exercise on 7/7. Now, if I was in charge of anti-terrorism in this country, I wouldn't just be looking for people in caves in Afghanistan. A lot of terrorism, as we know from historical fact, in the 70s and the 80s in the rest of Europe, the Bologna bombing, the Brabant massacres, the Dortmund beer massacre, the Dortmund beer hall massacre, all carried out by the security services using private companies as cutouts. Now, that is the sort of thing that the police need and the army need to understand if they're going to protect us.
Now, let's have a listen then to local hero Ben Fellows, who almost single-handed, it seems, has turned over G4S and the London Olympics. Here's his final word.
If there's a bigger picture that we're not seeing, it could be possible, say, invasion of Iran, say, for example, where they want to have a false flag operation and then say, Iran has bombed London Olympics, and now we're going to invade Iran, right? That could be a possibility. False flags are always done, really, as precursors to something else. That might even be subtle. Even in Northern Ireland, a friend of mine who was in the army in Northern Ireland, he was in Tupara, he'd be ordered away from a checkpoint, or he'd say, move your men back to the base tonight, you're not going to be there, right? And he said, every time that happened to us, a bomb would go off or someone would get killed, right? So he knew what was going on. And he got frustrated because he's like, well, hold on a minute, how do you know this is going to happen? We're supposed to be here to stop these guys. He believed really, you know, in everything. So we know this goes on. This happens. If we can work out the bigger picture, is there a bigger picture? Then might be you're onto something. Mm-hmm. If you can't think of a bigger picture, then they're not going to blow it up just for the sake of it, because it's always about doing something else. You know, curtailing your civil liberties that little bit, which is what they were doing in Northern Ireland. You know, every time someone got killed or a bomb went off, the general population, those walls went up. The helicopters came, you know, whatever it is, they added something else onto it.
Ben Fellows there, the investigative undercover reporter at G4S. Now, Martin, this whole idea of the false flag, is it really possible that there may have been an attack? I think it's a lot safer now the army have moved in on the Olympics, and then there would be a real question mark. Is this an attack? Just a minute. Is it by the Iranians, or may it be by somebody else to make it look like the Iranians? This whole idea of the false flag.
Well, yes, I mean, we're speculating here, aren't we? We don't know if there's any such threat. But the fact is, historically, we know, and there's no dispute about this, there's been parliamentary inquiries in Italy, Switzerland and Belgium. And it's quite clear that the Western security services in the 70s and the 80s and the early 90s were quite clearly involved in fomenting terrorist actions in order to improve the, you know, increase the power of the security services. Look, there's a bomb gone off over here. We've got these communist, fascist, Islamist terrorists, and we need more resources to deal with it. Give us some more money, please. And we know this isn't conspiracy theory. This is historical fact. Anybody who wants to check it just has to go to their computer and put in the search name Gladio, G-L-A-D-I-O, and all the documentary material will come up. Now, in other words, if I was in charge of running the security at the Olympics, I would be worried about random people turning up from Afghanistan or whatever, but I'd also be worried about the security companies actually directly involved. I would be looking at them very closely, and that's probably why security should be run only by the state and not by private enterprise at all.
Simon?
Well, I don't know. I kind of feel that we may be going with a conspiracy theory too far. I would hope that a company that is contracted to provide security, whilst it may may prove to be less than competent, at least is doing an honest job. But I think there is a broader point that when you start having profit making companies involved in the delivery of public services, and particularly the ones that involve things like security, there is, you know, they do have an incentive, I suppose, to make people feel less secure in order to increase the demand for their services. And I think in this instance it may be a conspiracy theory too far, and I don't know all the details of the cases that Martin's talking about, but there are an interesting parallel that I've read about was judges in the United States being, and this is, you know, they've since been prosecuted and it's, you know, all freely available in major newspapers and things, but the judges in the United States who took bribes from private prison companies in America in order to find quite often young people guilty because they needed them to fill their prison numbers and keep their profits up.
So you're talking about a conspiracy theory too far, but do you think privatising police, as G4S are threatening to do, that could be a privatisation too far?
Absolutely, yeah. I think that privatising, it's one thing maybe privatising some of the backroom functions of the police and how they procure their IT and their databases and things like that. But when you the role of when you're talking about actual police on the streets, looking after communities and with the power to arrest people, then they should, I think, absolutely be direct employees of the state. They shouldn't be employees of a private company.
Well, before we get off the subject of police, on our next story is tomorrow's EDL March and Pride March, plus the contrary one that's taking place in Bristol. I'm told something like 200 yards between them, which seems a little bit silly. But anyway, our reporter Marina Morris has been out on the streets asking you what you think about the potential threats or otherwise of immigration of Muslims.
The English Defence League are warning of a Muslim takeover of Britain. Do they have a point?
No, I think they've contributed to the diversity of our society. What's caused it? People are scared of change in society and the introduction of new cultures and ideas.
No, not really.
It's silly. It's just silly. The amount of stress that they put on this. They're just basically using it to describe their rampant racism and xenophobia.
It's a really good way, I think, of galvanising people, again, around a point, but I don't think their point is actually any different from what he said, basically. It's the acceptable face of racism at the moment.
They are definitely wrong. I think one of the best things I've found in Britain since I came here is the diversity and multicultural. I think that's a richness for this country. I came from Spain, so in that way I'm even an immigrant myself, and I've been treated really respectful and great here, and I think that's what make a great country like this one, is the diversity. People from everywhere be living in peace and respect each other.
We accept all communities here in England, and I think everybody plays their part within it, and as long as that continues, I think it's fine. I think there's a problem with a bit of tension between, you know, the communities, but that's just derived by a small sector of people. Most people get on, and I think that's the way it should be.
No, I think they're missing the point.
Have Muslim immigrants take something away from Britain? If so, what?
I don't think they've taken anything away. I think Britain is evolving to be a very multicultural place.
I think they've added, if anything. I really love the fact we've got more variety in food. Yeah. I like, you know, seeing loads of different clothes, different colours, different ways of thinking. I think it's fantastic.
It's never really been that much of a problem in Bristol anyway.
They have bring things to Britain rather than take away. This is everyone who comes from abroad usually bring new things, new food, new culture, new literature. And in Spain we have also had immigration from Muslim countries, but not now, for over the centuries, and great part of our culture became from the Muslim war 5 centuries ago, and since then there has always been a new addition to our culture, and we mix together, and it's a great thing that is happening here.
Well, I don't think they take anything away. I think they add to the cultural diversity of the country. I mean, the way the world is going is we're becoming more and more integrated as a society anyway. Nothing's going to stop that. So I don't think they've taken anything away. I think they've just kind of added to, which is a quite a nice culturally diverse community.
Nothing
at all.
Added to it.
Nothing but enriching for our country to have people from all around the world, and we should all be living in harmony, and this is completely wrong and disgusting, and it's an utter joke, and it's a shame that so much time and people's money and energy will be wasted putting on this rather than actually trying to sort out some of the problems the country does have, which have nothing to do with Muslims.
Would you be concerned by plans to build a mosque near to your home?
No, it's no different to any other church or place of religion.
No, I've got a church by my house now, and it's really nice because I hear the bells every hour, and I don't think it'd be any different if there was some other kind of noise.
I'd be more concerned if there was, like, a backlash against building a mosque, because, you know, that's just going to rankle the Muslim community. It's basically victimising them if you sort of rally against it.
Oh, not at all. I myself, I don't follow any religion, I'm Muslim, no Christian, not at all, but I think we should respect every religion and their sacred buildings. So I think they've got the same right to have a mosque like the Catholic to have a Catholic church or any other religion.
I don't think I would. The only problem that I would have with it, I think, is that because there are, you do get the kind of pocket of fundamentalists within each group, any group that you kind of have. I think that's the only concern that I would have, is that, you know, when you do get groups of whether it's whites, whether it's Muslims, whether it's blacks, you know, sometimes there can become this kind of almost gang mentality between them, and if you've got somebody who has sort of far-right views on something, it can spread throughout a community, and that's the only problem I'd have. But generally, if everyone keeps themselves and everyone's happy and everybody wants to involve everybody else within their communities, well, there's no problem at all, in my humble opinion.
Only as concerned as I would about a church or a synagogue or any of the other ones. Yeah, no.
Well, there's not really a lot of support for the fears of an Islamification of Bristol. Simon Rayner, Lib Dem councillor for King's Weston. Your thoughts then on the wisdom or otherwise of allowing this racist march in the city?
Well, it's I mean, it's fairly clear from the information available that the EDL is a pretty unpleasant organisation, or at least contains quite a lot of fairly unpleasant people. But they are, you know, they're also a legal organisation, and they have a right to express their views. On a practical point, the advice that we've had from the police is that that banning the march would actually create more problems than allowing it. If it's allowed, the organisers of the march have to stick to a specific route. They have to cooperate with the police in organising the march, and it can be very, very carefully policed. If it's banned, the police suddenly lose that element of control. There's still nothing to stop the individuals who might want to be involved in coming to the city, and also it creates the publicity. It gives the oxygen of publicity they want. If they're, you know, it allows a far right group to portray themselves as if they were banned as kind of, you know, martyrs for freedom of speech, you know, helps them feel kind of more legitimate in their grievances. So I think allowing the march to happen is not ideal, but it's probably the least bad solution.
But what about the date? I mean, clearly having it on the same day as the Pride March, I mean, surely that's just a crazy thing to do, because you're going to almost guarantee to have a heightened tension on a day when there's a march of people from a different point of view happening so close by. I mean, you know, I mean, you wouldn't have to ban it necessarily, just put it on a different weekend.
Well, the EDL have said to the police that they have no particular interest in the Gay Pride Festival, and that they, you know, that they have no they have no objection to it.
Well, that's fine. Have it a different weekend then.
I think it actually has come down to a practical issue, in that there are a lot of things going on at weekends in the summer in Bristol, some of which require police resources. The original date that I understand the EDL wanted to use was the date of the Harbour Festival, which clearly would have been problematic because there would be huge numbers of people across the entire city. This was the alternative date that was proposed, and the police felt that actually that would be, in terms of them having enough resources to police the march, that was a sensible time to have it.
Martin, Mickey Bayliss, who's the EDL organiser of the march, is worried about the Islamification of Bristol, but what about this point on the timing?
Well, look, I mean, I agree with Simon here that the least worst option is to let the march go ahead. But people have got to realise, as it happens in Northern Ireland absolutely regularly, and it's the marching season in Northern Ireland. There was a face-off in Belfast yesterday between a Republican and a Loyalist march, which turned into a little bit of bother. This is normal stuff. People want to demonstrate, other people want to counter-demonstrate. I think the good sense of the people of Bristol came out in that vox pop. Most people are totally unfazed by the idea of the Islamification of Bristol. They just think it's a silly exaggeration, which it is. We know that the only Islamic extremist in Bristol was actually a convert to Islam, who then tried to make bombs in his Westbury-on-Trim flat, and he tried to make contact with the Muslim community round here, and they all thought he was nuts and dubbed him into the police. So I think that the community in Bristol is very robust. Hopefully everybody will have their march tomorrow. Those who want to make their silly point about Islamification can make it and then go home. The rest of us will be marching to oppose their views and to show the unity of our city. I hope there's going to be no trouble, and then we can all, they will all go away and get on with our lives.
Do you think
hopefully.
There are any legitimate fears over this idea of Sharia law?
No, none at all. I understand that people, for example, I used to be a community worker in Barton Hill, and a lot of Somali families turned up there very recently, and like Barton Hill used to be a rather closed community where they didn't have a lot of outsiders going there, and to have a huge change like that where thousands of people suddenly with a different culture suddenly they're your neighbours. There are, you know, people have legitimate fears about things like that, and I think we shouldn't ever get into a situation where we can't discuss those fears openly, and that anybody who says that they're not happy about the situation is to be branded as an outright racist. They're not. They're people who are just concerned. I used to work in the New Deal for communities, and I won't go on about that. I mean, the point is that in actual fact these things can be dealt with sensibly, especially if people are sensible.
Thanks very much. That's coming up now to the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to this week's guest, who is Liberal Democrat Councillor for King's Weston, Simon Rayner. After the news, the national emergency, but the rich are paying no tax. BCFM.